This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Cyber sexual assault. Digital domestic violence. It's a relatively new kind of crime, but no matter the name, it could happen to anyone. It happened to Darieth Chisholm. Darieth was an Emmy Award-winning news anchor at her local station in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. After a storied and decades-long career in journalism, Darieth decided to follow her own path, becoming an author, speaker, and business coach. She also pursued a romance that led her overseas to Jamaica's warm, sandy beaches. Darieth was on top of the world until red flags began appearing within her relationship. Darieth's partner began exhibiting controlling and compulsive behavior, such as making threatening demands and having violent outbursts. She promptly ended things, packed up, and moved back to the United States. But everything changed on New Year's Day 2017, when Darieth received a text that would make her world come crashing down. I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. If you do not return to this relationship, I will stab you in your heart and shoot you in your head. Those were the words sent to Darieth by her abuser that day. This threat frightened Darieth, but still, she refused to return to her ex. Days later, she received a message on WhatsApp with a video attached. She opened it only to find footage of her naked, sleeping body. The abuser saw Darieth's power and independence as a threat and wanted to undermine her dignity even further. Scared, yet standing strong, she rejected his threats and attempts at communication. Her abuser's obsession grew. He posted the video to a public website dedicated to shaming her and forwarded the video to business colleagues, her ex-husband, and others in her life. The monster was determined to silence Darieth and strip her of her dignity. But due to her strength, resilience, focus, and determination, she pursued legal action and took back control of her own life, winning a landmark legal victory. Darieth has used her story to fuel her activism. She founded the project 50 Shades of Silence to educate and to empower other victims of cybersexual crimes. Today, she joins me to tell her story and to share her words of encouragement for other victims and survivors.
Well, one of the worst New Year's I would say that I'd ever had. I mean, I think just as everyone was bringing in the New Year and toasting and celebrating, I got a text message from a former ex-boyfriend. This was back on January 1st, 2017, that said, "If you don't return to this relationship, I will stab you in your heart and shoot you in your head. And if I don't do it, I'll find somebody who will." And I mean, you can imagine what you'd feel like if you heard this from someone that you loved and you trusted and you'd broken the relationship off several months before. And then you get this awful text message. And I felt like he really meant it. And I was very afraid. But that wasn't even the worst with all of this. Because I didn't respond, a couple of days later, I get a WhatsApp message with a video on it. And I open the video and it's my naked body, all these photos that he had been taking of me while I was asleep without my knowledge, of me naked, camera between my legs, all showing my breast and private parts. And the message behind that was, "Now if you don't return my phone calls and return to this relationship, I will put this out on the internet and I will silence and destroy you. You know, so far this has been several years now, but even as I talk about this, it still brings chills to me because, you know, those types of threats you want to take seriously, but you think to yourself, you know, how could someone A, do this, had taken the videos. There were multiple videos from different accounts, but the possibility of him literally silencing and destroying me was real. I mean, I spent 30 years in television news. I built a very successful coaching business and still very much had a reputation, you know, as a somewhat celebrity. And so to have this hanging over me and knowing that the possibility of it getting out onto the internet was real was frightening. And so I called him, of course, and begged him to please not do this. And I, of course, I'm not going to return to a relationship that I had previously broken off. By then, it was like 6 or 7 months. But I couldn't not respond to him. And yet the more that I rejected him, the more it bred his obsession, to the point that he literally called my former television news station, my former coaching clients, and even my ex-husband, and he walked them to a website that he put up with all of the photos and the videos. And that's when, it was just, you could Google my name and you could find the website with all of the photos and the videos and text messages that we'd shared. And I was devastated. I was devastated by what was occurring. I was devastated by obviously those images being out there. And probably even more devastated was that there was literally nothing I could do. I'd called the police, the FBI, every and anything I could think about. And at the time I was living in Florida and there was no current law or anything that I could even, and he was living in another country. He was in Jamaica. This happened in Jamaica. I was now living in Florida. And so it was like my hands were tied.
Can you share, Darius, in those phone calls to law enforcement, what exactly did they say? As you just said now, your hands were tied. What did they say about their inability to act? Did they say there's just nothing illegal about this whatsoever? How did they explain it to you?
Yeah. In fact, I had an officer come over and take a statement from me. And, you know, I told him about everything that had happened. I even showed him the website. And I was really afraid to like show people the website. But of course, I had to show evidence of this. And he said, I don't think there's much that you can do about this. This is a personal case. It's not something that we would get involved with. I immediately started looking for attorneys or someone who could help me out. Was really fortunate to find an attorney in Florida who, you know, was working in, and you have to, this was back in 2017. And at the time, you know, revenge porn and non-consensual pornography, cyber sexual assault, it has a dozen names, but basically it's the same thing. There weren't many attorneys at the time specializing in this. However, this attorney at least suggested that I file a protection from abuse order mm-hmm. in Florida courts and then go to the courts so that at least with the threats that he'd made, even though he was living in another country, we had that in place. The other thing that was really important was that I get the website taken down. And I sent GoDaddy and Google 1,000 messages with photos and links to all of this. And their response was, nothing we can do about it. You need to get a DMCA takedown notice. And frankly, because he took the photos and he's the one who has bought the website, he owns the photos and the images. Even as I say that right now, I think about how ridiculous that is for every victim out there who unfortunately has content that someone else is slaying across the internet with the intent to do harm. And that was equally frustrating. And so now here I am in court begging the attorney, because what GoDaddy and Google said is you will need to get a court order from a judge requesting us to remove the website. It took the judge 11 months. And I can remember saying to the judge, and I will say this exactly the way that I said it, and I'm like, it took you 11 months. My case got dropped. We had to go back multiple times. I said to the judge, you know, thank you, but it took 11 months. Imagine if your pussy was on the internet for 11 seconds because that was exactly what my experience was. And fortunately, prior to that, however, I was able to get a DMCA takedown notice issued from a company out of Canada who was able to shut it down. But I still remained in court for several months afterwards, just so that I had something from the judge in case he put the website back up.
And can I ask you, this is, you know, it's ancillary, but it's important. How much did you spend as you spent these, you know, notwithstanding the emotional toll, obviously, and the pricelessness of that, so just set that in the back burner for a moment, but the actual cost, I can only imagine, of you, all these attorneys, all the court, all the way, how much are we expected to pay to protect ourselves at that time in 2017?
I can't even recall the number, but I would say it was, you know, well over $30,000-$40,000. Well, I mean, because I was also needing to travel back to court and attorney's fees. And yeah, it was quite expensive. And even more so, of course, is the emotional toll. And also the fact that I like most victims, unfortunately, this level of humiliation and shame forces you to, I mean, many people become depressed and they can't work and they, you know, people lose their jobs, they lose their livelihoods. I mean, at that point I was self-employed, but I didn't feel like going and speaking on stages and coaching clients and being on television. It was a very taxing and emotional time.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
I'm curious, in the course of the navigation of the court system, which, again, was a different time then, so it was ill-equipped at best, were there any issues with jurisdiction or the fact that he was Jamaican? Was that challenging for you in that way? And if so, could you describe that?
Absolutely. That was perhaps the most challenging of sorts. First off, every time that I would have to hire someone in Jamaica to serve him each time that we went back to court. And he never came, but he hired an attorney in the U.S. to show up. And then we would do like live Zoom sessions. And yet I had to hire someone to give him the papers every single time. The judge, in all fairness, while she was ill-equipped to even understand what this form of cyber harassment was, it was, I think at the time it was under this interpretation that because this happened outside of Florida jurisdiction and it happened in Jamaica, that her hands were tied. However, my attorney at the time found ample court cases suggesting that victims who do live in a particular jurisdiction can be protected under the four corners of the law by, you know, by crimes of this sort. But because it had never happened there before and the judge, that is part of the reason why she would throw the case out and we'd have to come back and find something else and she would throw it out. And so it was a back and forth of time in court, primarily educating the court system and the judge, but obviously also just at least trying to get what I needed from her. And the only thing I really was requesting was the language so that I could give it to GoDaddy or Google if the site became live again.
It's disheartening to imagine that in the space of a novel decision, meaning a first-time application, obviously from, okay, so these other jurisdictions have found this, your attorney brought essentially precedents in other jurisdictions. It's disheartening to hear that a judge would not say, well, then I'm going to be the first one, I'm going to apply it here, and let the appeals court overrule me. Let the appeals court overturn me, because the stakes here is your protection. I would err on the side, if I were the judge, of the victim's protection. And we know that criminal impact, the impact of a crime, that is enough, or it's one of the factors to establish jurisdiction. So much of this is so, it's just so disheartening to hear. I mean, I can't, and you lived it.
Yeah.
So tell us, okay, so then what happened?
So I was able to get the website. It was up for about 3 months, but with the DMCA takedown notice, we were able to get it out or taken down while I was still in court. And then the thought occurred to me that I need to go public with my story, because I'd spent 20 years anchoring the news in Pittsburgh. And the last thing that I wanted was for me to be behind the story. And so I figured I'd break my own story. And so I called my former television station and my general manager there and told him what was happening to me. And he agreed. They brought me in. I was able to disclose what was occurring. And at the time, I was virtually unaware that this was happening to other people. In fact, I had been doing a lot of research to try and figure it out. And there were very few organizations and things that were out that were helping people, with the exception of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. And so when my story came out, it went international. In fact, there was lots of media coverage. And then people started calling me from around the world. This has happened to me. I've had a very similar incident. I had so many married women who were going through divorces who had in their own consensual relationship with their husband taken photos, shared information, what have you. And then as they were going through their divorce, their husbands or soon to be ex-husbands were threatening them with material that they'd shared. It was a really interesting time because it was coming from all directions. And that's when I decided that I would film a documentary and start a social justice project, a website with resources and information for victims called 50 Shades of Silence, because I was so lost at the time. There were no ways to tell people what to do. And I just scrambled to put together a website to say, hey, if this is happening, here's some suggestions. I started hearing from multiple people, and I thought the only way I know how to defend myself is to use my voice and my story. And I cobbled together a film crew, and we started interviewing other people so that I could, direct and produce the documentary. But the thing that came out of that, which was probably the most profound, and as much as it was great for me to share my story and the stories of other people, and I know that that was significant in terms of helping people who were going through the same thing, was my story ended up on the front page of the newspaper in Jamaica. And part of that story was the entire time I had been in contact with the Jamaican police, the constabulary force there, asking them to please get involved. And their responses to me, and I would send them all the photos, the videos, everything. And this was prior to the website being shut down, by the way. So this has been several months of me in conversations with them. They said to me, we're only going to get involved if you mail us your laptop and your cell phone. And I said, I need my laptop and cell phone for work. I've emailed you everything. I took very good notes, all the photos. Here's the evidence. They wiped their hands of it. That story was on the front page of the newspaper in Jamaica. And I'm so fortunate. There was a Homeland Security officer who had been recently stationed there, who's having a cup of coffee, and he reads the story. He Googles my name and he calls me and he says, Darius, I'm reading your story. I'm so sorry this is happening. I'm here in Jamaica. Can I help? And I'm so grateful for that, because Tony Scott, Homeland Security Special Agent Tony Scott, is like an angel for me. Like, literally, I still get chills, because if it had not been for his involvement, a couple of things wouldn't have happened. First off, he spearheaded the investigation there in Jamaica. He was able to get the court system as well as the U.S. Embassy in Jamaica, Homeland Security, and the constabulary force to be involved to wage an investigation. He was able to go back to GoDaddy and Google. By then, the website had been scrubbed, but they were able to pull all of the content from the website, track the IP address to his cell phone and his laptop, which is exactly what we needed for proof. And I didn't have to mail my devices to Jamaica. And they were able to put together a sting and operation. They arrested him. And a year later, this is actually more like 2 years later, I flew to Jamaica and we had a court case. The Jamaican government had recently issued a Cyber Crimes Act, which is very new there. But the language in that Cybercrime Act is spelled out so clearly. And I want to move to the conversation about what's happening in the court systems here. But there in Jamaica, basically, to reduce the conversation, the language pretty much says, if a person is found to have purposely retrieved and or taken photos or information or videos that is harming to another individual and is disseminating that content with the intent to do harm, they can be brought up on charges. And because we had so much evidence and this act had recently been passed, this was the first case that was successfully won. He pled guilty to three counts of malicious communication, and then was later sentenced to $1 million JA dollars, which is a few thousand dollars here in U.S. dollars, and 2 years prison sentence. However, he, to my knowledge, only served 6 months of it. But that is significant because here in the United States back in 2019, at best, we had some states that had some statutes that spoke directly to revenge porn and non-consensual pornography. Most of them came with maybe a slap on the wrist and a $500 fine. So for me to have won a case in another country with a significant fine and jail time, I think was significant.
It was an incredible victory. Quick X's and O's question. Because it was so young, that act, the Cybercrimes Act, was it retroactively applied, or did he take and disseminate those images like just under after it had been written? Was it in place at the time that he did this to you, or did they retroactively apply it?
That is a good question. I'm not sure of that. I'm assuming that because by the time we got to court, it was July 2019. These incidents actually occurred in 2016, but he started publishing them online in 2017. So I'm not sure about the retroactive question that you're answering, but it was enough for, we had six counts against him. He pled guilty to three of them.
The act was 4 years old in 2019. So, okay, it fell within it. And the reason I'm focusing on that is because were this to be the case, which now it is, to me, it's just achingly beautiful timing. What an incredible relief. Because generally speaking, laws usually prohibit retroactive application. The whole point is that they say, you know, well, it wasn't illegal at the time. Now there's nothing we can do. Only now moving forward can we. And the fact that this law had actually been written and was light years ahead of the state's analogs in our country, that's just incredible. And I am so grateful for you that there was an avenue and a cause of action in a criminal non-slap of the wrist way for him to be held accountable. And no amount of jail time can ever come close to what you went through. But that aside, the message it sends and the victory you have is just, it's really incredible. And I'm grateful as well to the Homeland Security officer who happened to be reading it, and for someone to have seen you in that way and say, I want to help. I want to fulfill my duties so much more beyond what I was called to do in this daily task, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I owe, as I said, a huge debt of gratitude to Tony Scott and Homeland Security for a couple of reasons. Again, these crimes are happening all over the world, and many victims, unfortunately, particularly those that are outside of the U.S. when they occur, never find justice because of various jurisdictions and another country and all of the hoops that one would have to go through. And frankly, the division that he was in was human trafficking. And yet this was a cybers related crime. So that fell under it. And Tony said to me that because there was so much attention that we drove to this, and of course, these crimes are happening more readily, and my willingness to continue to push forward, because unfortunately, there are a lot of victims who it's a lot, it's very expensive, it's time consuming, it's embarrassing. They drop the case before they ever see any victory. And it was, you know, not only me fighting, but them being available to continue to push this through in another country that this, you know, was made possible. And I had completed filming the documentary by then. I was well on to entering it into film festivals and making it available from the standpoint of making people aware, and literally almost at the point of not going. I can remember telling Tony, I'm not coming. I'm done with this. I'm exhausted. You know, I've created this website and these resources, and I don't. And he said to me, Daria, if you don't come, they will drop the case and everything will be at loss. We need you to show up in court. I just didn't want to face him. Like, I just did not want to have to travel to Jamaica and be in the same room with him. But I'm really glad that I did. And, it was worth it all in the very end.
It calls to mind, too, as you talk about the international jurisdictions and challenges that presents. As sort of basic as this comment is, you know, the United States has such a different view of ownership and privacy, and versus the European model where the subject owns it. And here, for some reason, you know, the fact that it is viewed that the owner of the data is for example, in your case, the person who took the images. I mean, that is just asinine. And it is catastrophic and has been catastrophic in all of how we viewed the internet and all of how Europe has viewed the internet and how all of the cases have proceeded in this super divergent manner. And in Europe, they get privacy. For some reason, it failed to take hold here in that way. And it disturbing is like an understatement of the century. For the fact that you still have to fight, you have to prove why something is harmful, and you can't have ownership when it is you as the subject. It's just crazy.
And Emily, I think it also fuels what for most victims is so painful and presents as victim shaming and victim blaming. Because what happens, particularly with young people, and a lot of the young people who I hear from, is that in many cases, they do pose for the pictures. This is a consensual agreement between two people who are in a relationship, and they decide that, you know, they want to take naked photos or naked videos of one another, and they share them. This is in the confines of their relationship. And, again, unfortunately, this occurs with many couples and definitely with young people, but that still does not give the person who has the photos and the videos the right to disseminate it and to disseminate it with harm. And so when you have that overlaying, if this person used their cell phone and now they own the content, what I find is an insensitivity by the judicial system, by the law enforcement, because I heard this over and over again, and I still hear it from people, then you shouldn't have took the photos or you shouldn't have given them. And imagine a victim who, again, I just had the resources, the time, the money, the commitment, like all the things. And maybe I was somehow the perfect person to do this. I now understand why, but at the time I didn't. I was just willing and committed to protect my name because I did not pose for them and I did not know they were taken. And yet it still falls under the same situation. And so, you know, it's outdated. It's ludicrous. It's sad. And there needs to be a lot of overhaul, especially in the way that we view anything online, because the potential for extortion and continued cyberbullying and cyber attacks is substantial when we can't get clear about ownership.
You know, I got chills three times in your stories. And one of the times was in the very beginning when you talked about that initial text message that you received, because it brought me back to similar messaging that I've gone through. And it's such a crystallizing instant where the world stops and you realize the harm that you are in, or the threat, you know, when the threat comes through, just like the world stops and your stomach drops, and it's frightening. It is absolutely yes. frightening. And what I was curious about is how then, like, so soon after that sense of manufactured from the society that we live in, shame that you encountered, you know, the essentially in the cost benefit analysis or just the analysis in general of all of these things to you, these painful things, that shame played such a big part. And rightly so, of course. I mean, we're talking about this and in your situation, it was so, quote, clear, but it's so additionally painful that someone has to weigh, a victim has to weigh, a survivor has to weigh the potential impact negatively on a profession and on reputation and public shame. And that when it's actually clear as night and day that something is harmful and something is in the right and something is in the wrong, that there is still a very large ambiguous gray area that a survivor has to weigh as to whether she or he can pursue action or get help.
I thank you for putting words to the reason why I decided to do 50 Shades of Silence. It's because I knew that if I went through all of this, if, you know, I did the research, I contacted people, I did, you know, I spent the money, I spent the time, I waged a media campaign, I filmed a documentary, I used my voice and story, I did a TED Talk, two TED Talks. Like, if I did all of that and I was still facing this, imagine someone with limited resources, with limited time, with like most of us at the time, no direction as to what to do. You do what I did in the very beginning, which is to fall on the floor and drag yourself into bed, and maybe you get out of bed. And there were many times that I didn't. But, you know, I knew, I literally had come to a conclusion, and really it was catalyzed by a conversation with my son, who, when I had to share this with him, you know, he said to me, "Mom, I am so, so sorry that you're going through this, but I know you're going to get through this. You're the strongest person that I know. And besides, Mom, he messed with the wrong woman." And like, for my son to say that to me was at the minute I dropped into this awareness of like, okay, then who do I need to become now? What do I need to do to not only move myself out of this dark place, but move into a place that I am thriving? Because he had stripped that first and foremost. But then when I saw that there were so many other people out there, I knew that I just needed to use my voice and my story and my platform to try and support them. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I did. And, you know, it's so interesting, because even when I have these conversations, I am light years away from emotionally where I was, even, you know, from the standpoint of even the work that I do in the world. It caused me to shift into a different place of knowing that if hurt people hurt people, then surely healed people can heal people. And so most of my focus now is on supporting people on moving up that spectrum from shame and pain and humiliation into not be going beyond survival, but literally moving into a place where you have found light and you are finding a new way to not just recover, but to thrive. And you're coming from a place of love and compassion and joy versus those denser, darker emotions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it caused me to film a second documentary called The Way of the Healer, and to look at, you know, how can we more positively help people who go through this level of pain and shame and, you know, come out on the other side. And so, you know, you look back on your life and you think, you know, wow, this was really bad. And at the time it was, and now I understand it was for such a time as that, that allowed me to not only use my voice and story, but now to advocate for the healing of people who have faced major traumas and dramas.
More of the Fox True Crime Podcast coming up. Question about resources. When you spoke earlier about going to your station and saying, "I want to tell my story," and then you said you cobbled together a film crew for the documentary and stuff, I wanted to ask you about the level of support that you had at that moment. Was your workplace supportive of you telling your story? Did they help cobble that crew? Was this still out of your pocket? This was a one-woman army moving forward? And I hope you're comfortable answering that or comfortable with the question. It's just so that I can understand the landscape and the climate for you as you took those steps in this journey.
Yeah. So my station was highly supportive, and I'm really grateful that first off, they literally, we turned the studio into a beautiful set, and I was able to flush out my story. And, you know, typically on everyday news, you get, you know, a minute 30 at best. Mm-hmm. We had about 2 or 3 minutes to tell the story. By then I had put the website together, so at least there was some information for people to go to if in fact they saw themselves as victims. And I was also in the process of putting the film crew together. I did that on my own. I had lots of people who, when I said, I want to tell my story, can you help? They said, great. Now, the interesting thing is, just because you've anchored the news for 20 years does not make you a film producer or director. Although I thought I somehow was, and I became one. You know, I became a director, a writer, a producer, all the things, right? Like all the things. But I was so grateful for the people who heard my rallying call and stepped up. This was all out of pocket. I spent several tens of thousands of dollars to film. We filmed for about a year, by the way, because I wanted to continue to film my story in court, but I also crisscrossed the country interviewing other victims who had reached out to me through the website. And so the documentary 50 Shades of Silence is available on YouTube and at the website 50shadesofsilence.com. It's only 38 minutes, but what it takes, you know, we had about a year and a half of content in the can that I had to bring down to 38 minutes, which was a bit challenging, especially for a first time independent filmmaker, supposedly. But I'll tell you that the thing that drove me more than anything else was it was in some way my own way of healing. It really was. Like I did get some support and therapy. I was able to utilize, you know, I'd been coaching for some time, and as a life coach, I have many tools in my toolbox, and you know, rely on a great deal of spiritual support and own personal development support. But what I also found was there was something so therapeutic about being with other people who shared the same story. And I know it was therapeutic for them, because it was finally being able to share a story with someone who understood in a safe environment, and knowing that if nothing else, we've banded our voices together. It also happened right about the time that the Me Too movement was launching. Mm. And so it was kind of the same, you know, even though this was not necessarily sexual assault, it was still, you know, obviously victims who had been assaulted in some way, this, of course, being online. And so it really was in some ways very therapeutic. But no, it was, you know, I owe that team that I put together a great deal of thanks, because many of them rolled up their sleeves and said, yes, we got you. I had photographers from, I even hired some students from New York Film School. And if I went to another state, I'd find somebody who was available with a camera. And I mean, that's why the documentary is, as you see it, it's an independent documentary, but it's a story nonetheless by, you know, some eager so-called filmmakers.
Whose cause was bigger than all of us. I mean, that, right? That's yes. The point. It was the cause was bigger than the sum of all the parts. Can I ask you, back to the trial, back to the courts, what exactly was Powell's defense? What exactly was he arguing? And I know he pled eventually, but I'm just curious at what was actually articulated, other than the ownership that we discussed, but still, how was that even a question, especially once Homeland Security got involved and under the trafficking component? I'm curious what was articulated.
Such a good question. His first one was that I posed for them. His second one was that I staged all of this, that I wanted this. His third one was that I made him do it. It was ridiculous. And it was all defamation of character and gaslighting. And his attorneys, especially when they would show up in court in Florida, it would not know what would come out of their mouths. But they had all of these stories that he made up that were so untrue. I mean, even to the tune that I was trafficking drugs, and this was a way that I could somehow get out of the fact that I was trying to smuggle drugs back into the U.S. It was just ridiculous. And I would listen to that and his so-called testimony. And it was the same thing he was telling the Constabulary Force in Jamaica, by the way, which is why they wouldn't believe my case. They brought him in. They questioned him. They never questioned me. And he told them, I posed for it. This is me doing this. I wanted this to happen. I forced him to do this. I made him do these things. Mm. Yeah. It was, and if you would see the threats, because there were lots of text messages threats, it was very clear because the threats were in the text messages as much as the photos were there. And, you know, I don't know how any investigating police officer could ever look at all of the evidence that I had and ever believe that, but they did.
And what now is the status legally? Do you have an existing order of protection because those threats are very real also. You know, it yes, conveyed the harm intended, but it also, they are threats in and of themselves. And are you protected at this point from that individual?
I don't know. So the answer to that is no. And I try every day not to think about it. I try not to live under the initial threat. The first off, the initial threat, which was to my physical body, mm-hmm. Which was more alarming, was as alarming as obviously seeing the photos and the videos. But I will tell you that first year, it was, I stayed away from certain places. I left Florida as often as I could. I wanted to make sure I was always conscious about what was around me, who was around me. This is having someone threaten you and then know that now when I stood up and started fighting and defending myself, that the potential for him to push even harder existed, that, you know, that did scare me and alarm me. And of course I've had no communication with him, so I don't know how things are, but at last that I understand was that he had served the 6 months, and what I hope more than anything else is that he's completed this and he sees his wrong in all of this and that there is no need for me to feel threatened anymore online or offline. And, perhaps that is what has occurred. That's what I hope for.
Mm-hmm. And the hope too is that with these laws in place, with our inadequate ones and the cyber crimes one there, like that provides enough of a deterrent, that being on the front page, someone's conviction on the front page is enough to deter others so that this stops happening and emboldens those survivors to come out readily and to say, we will not stand for this. To our point earlier about the internet and just how difficult it is, it's always proceeding at a more rapid pace than the laws are. And then you get judges as what you experience. I say my hands are tied or I don't really know what to do. But the point is we have to either craft legislation that is appropriate catch-alls or have judges that say, well, this was the intent behind it. This is clearly harmful conduct. I'm going to go out on a limb and then make a case precedence. And hopefully Congress can catch up after. And having gone through similar things, information is so easy. It's easier to replace than to suppress or erase. And that is something that survivors encounter. And it is so, it's frustrating at best. And at worst, it's frightening again that Google, having had those same conversations with these vehicles where they're like, oh, sorry, just give us something else to put on top of it. Give us enough stuff so that it squishes this to the bottom. And it's like the truth doesn't matter. Me saying or proving this shouldn't be here. This should not exist on your platform. That is not enough. They simply want it buried under other things because suppression is what is okay, right? Because the business model exists on data. It doesn't exist on accuracy.
Yeah. One of the things that I did at the time that I was filming was I staged a march and a rally in Pittsburgh, and I brought together the other people that I had been talking with, those that I'd interviewed, other people that are in the space, like CCRI and March Against Revenge Porn organizers. And we staged a march and a rally, and we collected signatures to send to Congress to support. At that time, it was the Enough Act that mm-hmm. Then Senator Kamala Harris had written. And it had been, we collected in that 3 months, most of the signatures happened during the march and the rally, but then we kept the petition up. So we ended up developing this in order to show everyone, like, listen, we've got enough signatures here in support of this. Let's move this into a federal law, because we needed a federal law at the time. Of course, Kamala Harris, of course, becoming the vice president, and then Jackie Speier in California ended up taking some of that language and turning it into the Shields Act, I think mm-hmm. is what it was determined to be. Pretty much with the same languaging, but obviously with the hopes to continue pushing it through. And, I remember all of the conversations about, hey, we need a federal bill. Like, these statutes in the state laws, as I said, are flimsy at best. And at the time, there were a couple of states that didn't even recognize it. At least we could have an umbrella law in place. And, you know, it's been this quagmire of getting dropped and putting it in and trying to find enough teeth in it to make it make sense. And we really do. I mean, we need more laws in place because the languaging can be challenging.
And it's also disheartening, I find, when I ask lawmakers what the challenge is to getting something legislated, like what's holding you back? Just wondering what's holding you back from execute. Why is there not bipartisan support for this? And to learn that the lobbying effort is quite strong on behalf of the digital platforms, it's basically don't believe it when you see commercials that talk about help and controls for you to set settings and whatnot. Because at the end of the day, there's a lot of lobbyists on the Hill that represent these big data platforms, and they are resisting at every step any legislation being passed that would afford victims more protection. That's the bottom line.
You hit the nail right on the head. Exactly. There's enough interest through lobbyists and through these big internet companies to keep this spiraling and out of pure legislation and out of our systems. And so I absolutely agree with you. And I think that's been the biggest hang up. And, you know, for victims, again, who are sitting at home wishing and praying that now we know we can get things taken down relatively quickly on social media platforms. At the time, it was really tough. So that happens, but it doesn't mean that it's not already circulating. As fast as information and content goes, it could have been saved on someone's device. And as much as it's been scrubbed from the internet, who knows where it's going or what time, when is it going to pop up again? And, you know, by then it becomes so many people who are now contributing to this by sharing and texting and sending it on other platforms that, in my opinion, we do have to hold these internet companies, these providers, responsible in this, because they're the ones who are holding the content available on their IP addresses and in their systems. And if they don't move quickly enough to remove it, it really has to start there. And, you know, it's going to be really hard to go chase after every Tom, Dick, and Harry who might have a picture on their cell phone, when if we can get these companies to move more quickly, that would be great. I'll tell you the other thing I think that's really important too is that that there are more conversations and opportunities to educate, particularly young people, about social responsibility for texting and posting and even sharing. You know, as much as I believe that this is purely, it's not necessarily a consensual situation, but it does require people to have a level of sensitivity that just because you have that content does not give you the right to share it. And if you do, you could face punishment. If that language is out there more often, it might, you know, stop many people from texting and sharing and posting because they know their consequences.
Right. Because the laws account for the dissemination, but it's the amplification that is oftentimes so exponentially harmful to someone's reputation or their feelings of self-worth and depression and so much. So can you share with us what is holding your attention now? Is there a third documentary? Are you still, what's, tell us about you now.
This documentary is, I literally just released it onto YouTube. It went through the film festival route. It won several awards. I have had the great opportunity to speak to lots of businesses and internet providers and children and young adults about this. My TED Talk, of course, has been translated to 19 different languages. The website is still up. I hear from victims every single day, so I respond to them as best as I can. And I make it available as a resource that hopefully will help someone in their darkest moments. For me personally, my focus and attention is on conversations around healing. And I now have a podcast called The Way of the Healer. I'm also working on a docuseries called The Way of the Healing, which The Way of the Healer, and thewayofthehealer.com, which focuses on alternative healing modalities that allow people to move from stages of depression, pain, PTSD, trauma, things like that, by utilizing other alternative health modalities, whether it is yoga or meditation, psychedelics, plant medicine, higher states of and expanded consciousness work. Because I think when we start to move the needle on who we are as individuals and what role we play, even in our most tragic and devastating times, when we can, as I said earlier, move up the spectrum from shame and pain and trauma, which unfortunately leaves a lot of people in this situation in, and they find not only their courage, their everyday courage to get through this, but they move to a place of understanding, maybe this happened for me and not to me. We empower ourselves with a degree of understanding that we can get through this. And in fact, we can become more courageous and more powerful. And so healing is such an underrated experience, I think, for everyone, let alone people who have faced trauma. And so, again, my focus is on what does it mean to heal, and how do we love the world, and how do we expand in our consciousness to be happier, healthier, more loving individuals? And so my work is primarily in that direction. I really don't think that would be occurring right now if I had not experienced what I did. Mm-hmm. And so I almost owe that experience to now my life that is so far away from that. And I spend most days in this state of bliss and joy and happiness and peace, really advocating for healing. And this comes from someone who knew that there was no way that I could stay emotionally in the place, but that it meant for me to use my voice, my story, my platform to tell stories about healers and not hurt things. And so that's what I'm doing now with thewayofthehealer.com.
So 50 Shades of Silence is still live, and you still help others through that and collect their stories. In addition yes. to the Way of the Healer's ongoing project in multiple mediums.
Absolutely. Yes. That website, I will continue to maintain that and support the hosting of that, because there are tools and resources there. So, for people who say, oh my God, this is happening, I have a 7 steps. Like, what do I do if I find out this is happening? Which at least may help them from the very beginning to take some initial steps. So that's there. The documentary is there as well. So if Great. Anyone wants to watch the documentary, it's there. And the TED Talk is there, the resources. And then, frankly, Emily, one of the things that I see happening more than ever before is sometimes people just want to be heard. And so I get women and children and sometimes men who send me, because it only comes to me. No one else views this. I read their stories and I respond. And if nothing else, that helps so many people, because they feel like they can't share this. They're in such shame. And so I do that just so that I will always be like a light out there, so that if nothing else, even if they can't figure their way through, you got somebody who understands it, who's listening, and who's here for you.
Mm. Bless you. That's an incredible place for you to sit in, to receive so much of that. And to your point, you're whole and healed and filled with joy and abundance. And so you are able to receive that without penetration.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of this story. On that point about sort of having a playbook for others who don't know where to go, upon reflection of your time that you knew Powell, that you knew your ex, were there any indicators that this was possible or probable that you identify and would like to share with listeners if they are trying to assess in their current situation whether this could be something foreseeable for them?
Absolutely. All the signs were there. And interestingly enough, one of the things I discovered with all the people that I interviewed and even the stories that I get from people is there are some telltale signs that I think everyone should be aware of. And I will say, first off, because even in the documentary, I interviewed psychologists and psychiatrists and other people in this space as to why do people do this? And there's a pure indication that in most cases, many of them are narcissists and sociopaths. Mm-hmm. And each of those characteristics present in a certain way. And there are absolute signs for that. for me personally, which was the reason that I ended the relationship as quickly as I did. I moved out of the country to go live with him in Jamaica, and we were together for a couple of months. And while he never physically touched me at all, I could tell just in his response that he would blow up in anger. He would make certain comments. There were just signs that made me feel very uncomfortable. And so I was out of there very quickly. I did not need to stick around in what might have turned into something that was physical. I've heard from so many people who say that they are enduring what would probably be described as domestic violence. And then when they leave that relationship, or even verbal violence, that perpetrator then finds a way online to continue to assault or abuse them. And so this becomes an extension of that. And so to reduce this down, if you are in a relationship where you feel threatened, where a person is telling you that they are going to threaten you, or worse, they're saying, if you don't do these things, that I will hurt you, harm you, abuse you, put this content out, that believe them. Believe them and get help immediately. Because this is where I think in some instances, the early signs present. And as I said before, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but having interviewed one and said that there are signs, particularly of sociopathic tendencies as well as narcissist tendencies, that are the early indicators that someone might decide that they want to control someone in this way. Or even if someone is gaslighting you or making you feel a certain way, those are the things to look out for. And I get it. There are many people that are in relationships and they can't leave and they think that they have to stay. But frankly, this is no different, in my opinion. Digital domestic violence is what I call it. You can call it revenge porn, non-consensual pornography, whatever. I labeled it digital domestic violence. It's like experiencing a form of physical violence, sexual violence, or emotional violence. While it isn't as significant, and I don't mean to make light of anyone who's unfortunately experienced that, and I do understand the gravity of that, the propensity of pain and shame and abuse that can happen online is as significant if it were happening to you physically. So those same signs could easily be the same signs that this could occur.
Daria, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your incredible advocacy and for really being such an absolute trailblazer for so many people to look at you and say, that is my hero in this moment, for standing up and for using your voice and using your platform when so many, truly millions of Americans don't have anything, and now they have you. We're so grateful. Are there any last messages you would like to share with listeners before we close?
Those listeners who might be experiencing this is who I mostly want to share this with, and or anyone who is around them. And that would be, you didn't do anything wrong. I think that's the biggest thing, is that when someone finds themselves in a state of victimhood, that they then beat themselves up and make the shame even more painful. So find a way to love yourself. Find a way to get the support that you need, even if it's a good friend. Find the resources and tools and collect all the evidence, collect and save anything that you possibly can, and move quickly to get it removed. Move quickly to get it removed, because this moves faster than most people even know. And know that there is light on the other side of this, that you can get through this and quite possibly be a actually happier, more grateful, more sound, more courageous person when you get on the other side. There is a place on the other side, and there is a place for you on the other side.
Yeah. And I know without a doubt that everyone is stronger than they think, and that with you here with us, no one is alone. You are everyone's ally, even going through the slightest bit of this. We are so grateful for you. Thank you so much, Daria. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at briankilmeadeshow.com.